Welcome to the Big Boat Interview. Now today I'm joined by someone who has truly sailed beyond the edges of the map, Captain Mywin Beadle. From single-handing a 14-foot lifeboat across the Caribbean to commanding superyachts through the ice-strewn Northwest Passage, Mywin has spent more than three decades at sea, often where charts end and the ice begins. A passionate explorer and pioneer, she spent the past decade guiding yachts through some of the most remote and fragile regions on Earth. She also holds a remarkable first, the first woman ever to captain a superyacht through the Northwest Passage, and she's captained countless expeditions to the Arctic. We're thrilled that Mywin will be joining us at the Explorer Yacht Summit, where she'll take part in the panel debate, Are Permits Holding Back Exploration? Hosted in association with Darman Yachting, this one-day summit will be held on the 13th of November at the Yacht Club de Monaco. Tickets are still available and we'd love to see you there. But for now, let's dive in and hear more from Captain Mywin Beadle. So Mywin, hello!
Incredible introduction. I really appreciate it.
So nice. I want to know all about your illustrious career. So you grew up quite far from the sea, near Reading in England, and graduated as a fine artist, is that correct?
I didn't know anything at all about boats until I was travelling across the South Pacific and I hitchhiked a ride on a small yacht sailing from Rarotonga to New Zealand. So that was my first experience on a boat at all.
But I mean, you know, that's quite a leap. Was there anything in between that? What first drew you to the sea?
No, that was it. I literally... I was going to go and ride a bicycle around New Zealand, and I was doing a stopover in Rarotonga, and I met a gentleman in a bar who had a small 36-foot sailing boat. I hitched a ride with him from Rarotonga. As we were sailing out of Rarotonga, one of his friends said to me, "You know, Mywin, either you'll never sail again or you'll sail for the rest of your life." And he was oddly correct, because I definitely did sail for the rest of my life. So we sailed out of Rarotonga and the weather was really quite awful. And my first experience helming a boat was in the middle of the night in about 80 knots of wind after the captain had been on the helm for probably 24 hours trying to keep the boat under control. And he looked at me and he said, "Mywin, I have to stop now. You're going to have to take the helm." And so I did. And that was it.
And so you literally had never been on a boat before?
Never. We put my bicycle underneath the tender on the foredeck. That was my initial sailing experience.
Oh my God, that's amazing. So 18-foot waves, did you say?
80 knot winds.
80 knot winds in the middle of the night, and you were just handed a helm on your own.
Had a helm, yeah.
And you did it.
I didn't really have any choice, actually. He just kind of pointed at the compass and said, like, keep this pointing in this direction. And then he went down. And he went down. He was exhausted. There was really no choice. So, yes, in at the deep end, learning how to sail.
I mean, were you terrified?
I definitely remember having a bit of a negotiation that if we got through this all okay, I promised I would probably go and have a normal life with a house and a cat and everything. But obviously that didn't work out. So was I terrified? I would say yes, probably. But I think in the middle of the night, when you're in the middle of the ocean, you don't really have a lot of time to process that feeling. And I think that that's something that goes through, you know, everything I've done ever since. Is people often ask me if I'm afraid. And the answer is, you know, I'd have to be... There's no place in the Arctic for people who aren't afraid. You have to have that fear and respect, but you also have to be able to work through it and control it. So, you know, was I afraid? Yes, almost certainly. Did it stop me doing it? And has it stopped me doing anything since? No.
So you, from that experience, what happened? So to chart the sort of course of your career. So what, obviously it didn't put you off. You obviously were allowed to go to bed at some point and yep. then woke up the next day and thought, I'll have another go, and then yep. another go. How did you progress from that to where you are now?
So, I mean, I think one of the things that helped cement the fact that I was going to be sailing forever was that our next port of call was Niue, and at that time there was no plane out of Niue, and the next boat was in 6 weeks. So it was either leave on the boat I came in on or spend 6 weeks in Niue. So I chose to leave on the boat I came in on. So, you know, and then after that, it was all a lot easier. So from there, I ended up going to the south of France, finding a job on a super yacht, and then working my way through up through the ranks on super yachts until I was a captain on a 100-foot sailboat. Then I went to work for a company called Uncruise in Alaska, which is adventure passenger vessels. So the vessels are 50 to 70 meters and take between 80 and 100 passengers. And they spend all their time in anchorages and we're doing kayaking and hiking and that kind of adventure. So I spent 3 years working with them and I was going to my last rotation on board and I received an email and the email said, "Hi, I've just bought this converted ice class tug that's now a yacht and I want to sail through the Northwest Passage. Do you want to be the captain?" I think by now we've established that I don't often say no to adventures. So I said yes, and then I went away to work out exactly what that meant.
And who was this email from?
This one's an NDA, I'm afraid.
I mean, you said yes immediately. So what drew you to these off the beaten track destinations? I mean, and also the Northwest Passage, did you know much about it? Was it something that you'd been yearning to do? Had you ever got any close to it before you said yes to that email?
No, I think so. The way that I look at myself is that I am an explorer who drives a big boat rather than a big boat captain that goes on expeditions. So, you know, my whole life has been doing interesting trips to interesting places. And this one just seemed like a super interesting trip. And obviously, you know, having been in Alaska, which is also an incredible location, and spending some time going up to glaciers in Alaska, there was some knowledge of ice and the appeal of that ice can have, but not to the extent, obviously, that I now understand it.
And tell me about that first. I mean, what's your overarching memory of that first trip up the Northwest Passage?
So the first trip was we went up into Greenland and into Lancaster Sound, and the plan was to get comfortable with boat operations in that area and to really understand what we were getting in for the passage, to go through the passage next year. I jokingly tell the story of how the first thing I did was go and look at YouTube on how to drive an icebreaking tug, which you can actually find on YouTube. And I did actually, this was the first thing I did. That's, you know, quite an understatement. Obviously, it was a degree of school. I had to go into my polar and my basic and my advanced polar in Finland. And, you know, spent some time studying how ice charts and all of these things work. And then I was very fortunate to have an owner who was very curious and wanted to learn with his boat and was happy for me to learn along with him. So we started with small, easy bits of ice and worked our way up from there as to, you know, what the boat could do and what the boat could handle. So the first year we did that. And then the second year was, unfortunately, COVID. The third year, they wouldn't let us into Canada because of the COVID regulations in the Canadian Arctic. So we instead took a trip up into Nares Strait, which is between Canada and Greenland. And we went up to Ita, which is as far north as you can possibly go in that area. We got right up to the ice sheet, which runs all the way to the pole. And we put the bow of the boat up on the ice sheet. And then we went to visit Ita itself, which is used to be the most northerly inhabited place in the world. It's no longer inhabited. And there are the remains of the huts there that were used by Perry and Cook and some of the other expeditions that headed north to the North Pole. So it's an amazing, magical place and almost nobody goes there.
Okay. And so that sort of gave you the experience.
Yeah, I gradually built up the comfort level of what you can do and how close you can get, where the safety margins are with time and with experience and with spending time with other people who'd done the same thing and talking to them about what to do and how to do it.
Okay. Did you have other people on the boats that could help you?
Some of the time, and then some of the time I used a remote consultant.
Okay. And so, yeah, just tell me, I mean, you know, you're on the ice. Tell me about the ice. How does it behave? What do you have to look out for? Well, you know, how difficult is it? And how, you know, how challenging is it?
Every day I'm in the ice, I start my day by looking at the ice charts and the satellite images. So I am constantly aware of what's around us. I think, you know, like things like Starlink have made it, it's been a game-changing difference in that I can download an image which is maybe 12 hours old, maybe it's not even that, of what's actually happening. So I can watch the movement of the ice in real time. I can see where it's breaking, where it's thawing, where it's moving to. I'm watching the weather reports constantly, so I know what's driving it as it shifts around. So in general, it very much depends which kind of boat I'm driving at the time. If I'm driving an A1 icebreaker, then there's obviously a completely different set of parameters than if I'm taking a 60-meter high-performance sailboat up into Greenland. And so my constant balance is, what are the parameters for the vessel I'm operating, and how do we maximize the experience for the clients versus making sure 100% that we're operating within set parameters and within safety margins, so that it feels magical, but it's also safe, because if it's not safe, then nobody's having any fun anyway.
Yeah. And I guess that you are always, you're 100 steps ahead. You're not just 10 steps ahead, you're 100 steps ahead. And so it's not just about guiding a boat through the ice, is it? It's more than that.
Yeah, it's a lot more than that. It's we often talk about me being an ice navigator or an ice pilot, but that's actually not necessarily the largest part of what I do. I do spend a lot of time doing that, but it's also, I spend a lot of time making sure that we're navigating safely in an area where it's very badly charted. A lot of the charts are very inaccurate, and working out how we bring the most amazing experience to a client so that they get to find places that they wouldn't necessarily find if I wasn't there with them.
Great. And why is the Northwest Passage so challenging?
You know, for hundreds of years, people tried to find a way through there and couldn't. It's a maze of narrow channels in the middle that's quite complicated navigationally. It's, again, very poorly charted. And most of the year, it's completely beset with ice. So there's maybe a couple of months in the year where it's now clear and you can move through. It's the most remote place I can imagine being. It's, you're hundreds of miles from anywhere. There's no support, and you have to keep moving all the time because the winter's coming in behind you.
And what would you say to other captains thinking of visiting, or, you know, going, or crew aspiring to join expeditions? Would you recommend they need certain qualifications?
Yes. The first thing I would recommend is, I would have found going to the Arctic much easier the first time had I had somebody like myself, an ice pilot or an ice navigator or a local guide on board. So that would be my first recommendation, is to take somebody who knows the area and knows it well, who can support you in finding your way through in a way that's safe and comfortable and fun. In terms of qualifications, there are definitely qualifications which are required for crew going through. Bridge officers, the captain and the chief mate need to have advanced polar, and the other officers on the bridge need to have basic polar. The problem is, most yacht captains don't get to spend the 60 days in the Arctic that's required to carry an advanced polar certificate in your COC, which means that in order to meet that requirement, then you need to take an ice pilot with you who fulfills that obligation.
And you, I mean, that's how you started. You had guides and ice pilots for you as well, didn't you?
I did not. it was quite a challenge. One of the things that is a standout for me as one of the captains who's taken a super yacht through the passage, so there are only maybe 20 or 30 super yachts that have been through the Northwest Passage, and most go through with support from an expedition company, and I went through unsupported. So it's very challenging, it's very stressful, And I did have other captains who were very experienced with me, but not other captains who had the experience in the ice.
So what first took you to the Arctic and what made you fall in love with it?
All right, so that was the story with being called at the end of my rotation to go and drive a boat through the Northwest Passage. That was my first Arctic. I always go in at the deep end, apparently. I don't ever go in halfway. Why did I fall in love with the Arctic? I mean, I think the same reason I fell in love with the ocean, which is there's an incredible peace that you find in these places in the middle of nowhere that you can't find anywhere else. There's a silence, even if it's not silent, if that makes sense, a tranquility that I find very difficult to find anywhere else in the world. So that enormous sense of peace is one of the things that takes me back to the Arctic, for sure. And then the quality of the light is just incredible. It's like a magical wonderland. It's like Narnia. It's just amazing.
Amazing. So what was the largest yacht you've ever captained and where did you go?
So I took over as captain of Nansen Explorer, which is a 72-metre A1 ice class yacht that was... I joined the boat in Svalbard and the next day we sailed across to East Greenland and we took a charter from Itokotomiut in East Greenland down around the bottom to Karatok. So that was the biggest boat. We did a science charter. We went into a number of fjords and it was absolutely incredible. We had a group of 12 scientists on board. So we got to see some amazing things and do things. We got permits for things that we would not have been able to do without having scientists on board. And I think that was, you know, that brought incredible value to the principal charterer.
Is it more challenging when you are captaining a boat that size, or is it's challenging whatever size a boat you captain?
I think that's a really interesting question. I think it is very challenging whichever size boat you're captaining. There is a level of responsibility with a vessel that size. There's less maneuverability. There's much bigger consequences. So yes, it's more stressful, I think. You know, I mean, I had 18 crew, 12 guests, some supernumeraries, so guides, and a helicopter pilot. We're doing helicopter operations. We are miles and miles and miles away from anywhere and anyone who can support us. So there is a level of responsibility there with that that's quite heavy. That said, you do also have the support of, I had very good mates on the bridge who were very qualified and very good at driving in ice. So there's both more responsibility, but there's also more support for that responsibility.
Yeah, because you're not just in charge of kit, you're also in charge of crew and obviously guest enjoyment as well. So there's lots of players to spin, I would say.
There's lots of players there. And I think, to me, the biggest responsibility is the other people that we are with and the people that I'm taking there, because I may understand where I'm going and the principal may understand where they're going and why they're going there, but not necessarily all of the crew have a full understanding and a comprehension of what they're doing and why they're there. And that's a responsibility that I have to make sure I make the right decisions for them above everything.
What is the main, is it people management? Is it chart reading, navigating, ice piloting? What is the one thing? Or is it just spinning all those plates at the same time?
It's the ultimate level of spinning all of those plates at the same time with the highest consequences that you can imagine.
Yeah.
A friend of mine who was on the bridge with me on my last trip, he was the mate with me. We came through some really heavy ice into Ilulissat and we're dodging through a pretty tight field of fairly large bergs. And after doing this for 2 or 3 hours, he looked at me and he said, "Well, Myron, it's like landing a jumbo jet over and over and over and over again," because it's this absolute focused concentration on maneuvering the vessel through the ice all the time. But then all the rest of it that you're talking about, that doesn't go away either. It's all still there. So it does definitely become a juggling act of being very focused a lot of the time. And it's something I've heard a lot of captains describe it as being, it's very exhausting.
And tell me about sort of the way ice, can you identify different, are there different icebergs, are there different growlers, there are different, can you look at a berg and divine whether it's a slow moving, fast moving? I mean, I don't know anything about icebergs, so tell me, impart some of your knowledge.
Oh, well, it's quite a big field. So, but briefly, we can divide it into a number of fields. So there's sea ice and there's glacial ice, and they're both quite different. So glacial ice, ice of land origin, is really hard. It's compressed in the ice pack up on the top of a country like Greenland, comes down as a river of ice, as a glacier, and then breaks off. And it can be very, very hard. You can actually tell whereabouts in the glacier the bergs come from depending on the colour. So if they're very blue, they're from the bottom of the glacier where they're very heavily compressed. If they're really gritty, they're from the side of the glacier where it's picked up all the dirt on the way through. So yes, to some degree, you can definitely tell the origin of glacial bergs. Sea ice is much flatter. It's less thick. So it forms a sheet, a flow. And depending on the time of year that you're there, and in general, we're operating in the summer months, so it's thawing, it can be quite rotten. You can break through that possibly, depending on your vessel. It's contact with that is a much less significant thing. So yes, there's lots of different kinds of ice. You can tell from the ice charts what they are. There are little numbers and formula on something called an egg chart, which explains to you what kind of ice you're expecting. You can also tell visually when you're in the area, and, you know, in one area, you're not going to go from one kind of ice to another kind of ice super quickly. In general, it'll be either glacial ice or sea ice or a mix of, but you're not going to find yourself suddenly in a completely different ice regime.
Which ice would you avoid? The blue ones, the very hard ones?
The dark blue. Definitely avoid all the dark blue ones.
Okay.
In general, you avoid contact with glacial ice, whatever kind of boat you have, unless you're up to the top level of ice class. So even with Nansen Explorer, I'm not smacking her into large pieces of glacial ice without some level of caution. They're very hard. They're very big. There's 9 times more underneath than there is on the surface. So they've got this enormous inertia. So you definitely, even if you hit a small one, you feel it through the vessel. So you're right. Definitely avoiding, in general, contact with glacial ice. With sea ice, it's a question of establishing whether it's older ice or younger ice. And you can tell that visually to some degree as well. It's also on the ice charts. So you're going to avoid older 2-year ice because that's much harder. It's compacted. It's driven out some of the moisture in it. That's very hard. We'd be avoiding that as well. Thinner first year ice, depending how thick it is, we might decide just to go through it.
Really interesting. I note to self, if next time I'm up in the Arctic captaining a 70 meter, I will know.
You can look it up on YouTube. I do. We have a little note on the bridge, and it has little diagrams. So, you know, like the chickens, and it varies obviously depending which boat we're driving. But, you know, like I might have chickens. Yeah, okay, you can hit the chickens. You know, badgers. Okay, you can hit the badgers. Okay, prams. No, you can't hit the prams. You know, and then you know a berg the size of a football stadium, you need to pass at, you know, 0.2 of a nautical mile. And so it's all there written down in a way that's quite visually easy for people to assimilate. So because obviously I have to leave my mates driving the boat at times, and so they need to know what I'm thinking and what's okay within what I'm thinking. So they get quite specific instructions. But the blue ones, definitely avoid the blue ones.
okay, lovely. Okay, let's talk about what is up there. So you've you know, some amazing wildlife as well as the scenery and the bergs. You've met polar bears, narwhals, so jealous, Arctic foxes. What's the one encounter that stayed with you?
I mean, I've been really, really fortunate to have some absolutely mind-blowing encounters. I personally, when I was growing up, it never crossed my mind that I would see a polar bear in the wild. And so obviously, you know, that's fairly up there. But the one that really sticks out in my mind was we'd been cruising for the day and we'd found 13 polar bears during the day in various places. We'd cruised along the shore and like every 5 miles there was a polar bear. So we'd seen all of these polar bears. And one of the guests said to me, "Oh my God, Marwen, amazing, so many polar bears. But when do we see the narwhals?" And I was like, "Well, I mean, this is the first time I'd never seen a narwhal at this point. So when do we see the narwhals?" So I was speaking to my partner that evening, and I said, "I don't know. I just the last day is tomorrow, and I just got no idea where we're going to find the narwhals." And he said, "Well, don't worry, darling. When you find the narwhals, and you will find when you find the narwhals, they will be singing." And I said, I'm like, okay, darling, whatever. And I said, the next day we're cruising around and I jokingly say to the crew, "Right, there's $100 bill on the crew mess board for the first person who spots the narwhals." And I went down to get some lunch and the phone rings in the crew mess and I pick it up and my mate who's on the bridge says, "I found them." And I said, no, you're joking. And she said, no, I found them. So I go back up onto the bridge and sure enough, there are the narwhal and we see them swimming along a bit and we start to get into shallow water. So we stop and all the narwhals stop. And my mate says, "Come up onto the Portuguese bridge," which is it's a walkway around the front of the bridge. So we're standing on the front of the Portuguese deck. And she says, "Can you hear them?" And I said, "No." She said, "No, listen." And you could hear them and they were singing. So we did actually find the narwhal and they were actually singing.
Incredible. What did they sound like?
They sound, you know, like the a little like the recording of a humpback whale, that sort of...
Yes. I'm not going to make it. But yeah, I don't know how a whale sounds.
They were making whale sound. And I think they'd obviously, you know, swum into shallower water as well. So we'd stopped. And, you know, we were a fair distance off them, probably at least quarter of a mile away from them. And they'd obviously swum into shallow water as well. And so they stopped and they all turned around. So they must have been talking to each other about turning around.
Wow. And the guest, what did the guest say when you pointed them out?
Wow. Wow. So, you know, I think it was absolutely a magical experience. And I think it's very difficult to find that experience. If I said you can't find it, it has to come to you. You have to be super careful. I think, you know, when this is one of the questions, I think you've got it maybe farther down, is the your interaction with where you are is something that we have to be very, very careful about.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing. Okay, and sailing yacht or motor yacht, which ones?
I think my heart's with sailboats. I do think my heart is with sailboats, but for the last, well, it's been quite a while now, actually, 15 years, I've been on powerboats. So, I mean, who doesn't love the silence of a sailboat sailing along and that beautiful power that you feel through the helm?
Yeah. And coming back, let's just talk about the narwhals were, you know, an incredible experience. Are there any other things that you've witnessed that you will go down in your sort of your biography?
Oh my gosh. I mean, I think every single day in the Arctic is pretty much up there with things that would definitely go in the biography. I think a few key things. I mean, definitely putting the bow of the boat up on the polar ice shelf and like looking north towards the North Pole and thinking you could walk all the way there. That's definitely pretty high. Obviously, finishing the Northwest Passage, sailing down south across the Arctic Circle, the other side into the Pacific. I mean, that was a massive feeling of achievement to have done that. And then the realization that it's actually still quite a fair way to get to Nome anyway. But...
Brilliant. Okay. And now you're joining us for the Explorer Yacht Summit this November to take part in a debate, "Are permits hampering Explorer Yacht travel?" So tell our listeners, how do you balance a desire to explore with the need to protect these fragile environments?
I think it's a very interesting question that we need to focus on quite strongly, that there's a lot of change within the Arctic areas. There's a massive increase in tourism. there's development not only within the tourism sector, but within the dynamics of countries. And a lot of the world interest is turning in that direction. And I think we need to be super careful with how we approach these areas and how we interact both with the culture and with the environment within these places, because there's no way that we don't have an impact. And we have to consider what that impact is, how we mitigate it, and also what positives we can bring in this area. I had a long conversation yesterday with a gentleman, and the discussion was about the difference between tourism and exploring, and how exploring brings a positive, how it gives back. And I think that that's super important, that we in some way try and bring a positive and give back.
Yeah, very true, very true. Maiwen, thank you for taking us off the charts today. So that's all for this week's episode of Boat International Podcast. A big thank you to Captain Maiwen Beadle for joining us today. And just a reminder, you can still buy tickets on the website for the Explore Yacht Summit on the 30th of November at the Yacht Club de Monaco. As always, don't forget to subscribe, leave us a review, and follow us at Boat International for more stories from across the world of yachting. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.